Hello and welcome to the first Silent London podcast, presented in association with SOAS Radio. Ladies, please remove your hats. My name is Pamela Hutchinson. I'm the tiny man who lurks behind the curtain of the Silent London website, and I'll be your host today. With me in the studio to crash a bottle of champagne across the hull of this podcast, our producer Pete Barron, helping us to avoid any uncomfortable silences.
Hello.
Hello. We also have a very special guest, Silent London contributor, cineast and pubology blogger Ewan Munro. Hello, Ewan.
Hello.
Today we're going to talk about the recent Carl Theodore Dreyer retrospective at the BFI South Bank in London. We're going to be looking forward to the British Silent Film Festival, and we'll be discussing some exceptional recent silent DVD and Blu-ray releases. We'll also be hearing an extract from a very controversial score for a very special silent film, and Sight and Sound contributing editor Mark Sinker will tell us all about his favourite silent movie. The music you heard at the beginning there is a snatch from Neil Brand's orchestral score for Hitchcock's Blackmail, so thank you to Neil for kindly letting us use it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything you hear on the podcast, you can email silentlondonpodcast@gmail.com, tweet me at silent_London, or leave a message on the Facebook page, facebook.com/silentlondon. It's fair to say that Danish film director Carl Theodore Dreyer is best known today for one silent masterpiece and a handful of majestic sound films made many years apart. But a recent retrospective of the director's work at the BFI South Bank went a long way to revealing the fact that his silent era years were by far his most productive. Dreyer started out in the film business at the Nordic Studio in 1913, at a time when Denmark was a world leader in cinema, and he worked there as a writer and editor for many years before making his debut as a director with The President in 1919. The BFI's Passion of Carl Dreyer season screened all nine of his silents, including the last one he made, the great The Passion of Joan of Arc. And I think we all saw a few of these. Mm-hmm. Ewan, you're a big Dreyer fan.
Yes. Yes, I am, yes. It's fair to say.
A big, big Dreyer fan.
Well, I mean, Gertrude is one of my favourite films, but that was his last film, and that was a long time after the silent era. It was interesting seeing the earlier films, which I had not been so familiar with, aside from, of course, The Passion of Joan of Arc.
I think a lot of people, when they first see a Dreyer silent, it's perhaps the comedy that surprises them the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are comedic elements even in those late films, that you have to look quite hard for them. It can be surprising.
It's a little bit more obvious, perhaps, in something like The Parson's Widow, though, which you had a mixed response to.
I found it very interesting. There was some funny stuff, I thought, quite outright comedy. At the beginning, there was a sort of contest to pick the town's sort of parson, and it had some great sort of clash of personalities there. I mean, Pete, what did you think?
I think what was interesting for me watching The Parson's Widow was the approach to religion. The only Dreyer film I knew beforehand was The Passion of Joan of Arc, which plays its religion very straight, probably too straight in some ways, because it's pretty much sold on one way or another Joan of Arc has got these visions and so on. Parson's Widow is a lot more flippant around religion, and it's very clear in those early sequences. I thought The Parson's Widow was delightful, actually. I thought it was very, very funny, really well presented. And I think the best sequences are these battle of wits in the centre of the film with the widow. The plot of The Parson's Widow is basically that a parson who is the new parson who is betrothed to his sweetheart discovers, to his horror, one must say, and certainly to his betrothed's horror, that along with the parsonage comes a widow who has outlived a number of parsons previously. Mm-hmm. So there's... I think I expected there to be more black comedy once I saw the plot, but it actually turns out to be really rather sweet, and what he learns from his battle of wits with the widow is very much about being a better person.
Humanity, isn't it?
Yes. He knows that it's probably wrong to pretend to be a ghost and scare...
or a devil.
Yeah, or a devil. It's a devil, isn't it, really? It's a very odd sequence, but very funny.
Yeah, I think there's the satire about the clergy, and then there's satire about religion, and I think he's very serious about religion and all the things, but, you mm-hmm. know, the clerics in The Passion of Joan of Arc are monsters because mm-hmm. they've not got true faith. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it's quite similar in a way. It's just taking the same attack, and it's quite soft in Parson's Widow, and it's much harsher in The Passion of Joan of Arc.
I think his religious beliefs and feeling do come through very strongly, even in the early films, if not as much as in the later ones. But I think he still has a very serious relationship to religion. And but the comedy is great to see. And there's comedy too in Once Upon a Time, of course, which is sort of a very light and airy film about... Well, it's a bit like The Princess Bride in some ways, I thought. It was just this sort of silly plot about aristocrat in...
Is it more like a fairy tale?
Well, yeah, like a fairy tale. I mean, yeah, the costumes, the set, it was very... It pushed it.
Was there plenty of action in it? Because that's one thing I didn't... There's a little bit of action in Parson's Widow, but I mean, and there's not really any action at all in The Passion of Joan of Arc, apart from there's these wonderfully staged tableaus and so on. Mm. But
and someone gets burnt at the stake and there's a riot.
Yeah, well, there's a little action there, but I mean, the
action's all in the faces, yes, and in the emotions, yeah, and that intense, yeah, kind of close ups, which is something that Dreyer was very good at.
Exactly. So I mean, I was just wondering if there was more of the an expanded tableau in that respect.
I think definitely that the plot of these things, the movement of them, is there's a lot more of it, and it makes it a little bit. These early films are not his greatest films. I mean, that's sort of implied by your intro to this. I mean, they're very interesting, and there's a lot of great elements to them, but there's a lot more plot in them, and
there's a lot of intertitles.
Yeah. You'd think silent films are silent, but they're not, and there's a lot of words on the screen. The Love One Another, for example, his film,
very complex,
about the Russian pogroms. There's about five or six screens of just pure text before we even get any imagery, and there's a lot of things happening in there. And it's not a boring or a bad film, but it's a much heavier film than I think.
Yeah, like Leaves from Satan's Book is quite similar to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got four stories in Leaves from Satan's Book, and was it three? Mm-hmm. And obviously, so you have to set the scene each time. But once you get in there, I mean, some of the strongest moments in a film like that are mm-hmm. the close-ups, are the emotional interactions between people. I mean, I think that. You've got in Bride of Glomdal, I think you mm-hmm. were quite fond of that film.
Yes.
It's the relationships between people, and definitely it looks forward to something like Audet with mm-hmm. the small sort of rural community mm-hmm. and so on, mm-hmm. and differences with churches. But the sort of river sequence at the end, to me, isn't as powerful as all of that.
It does seem a bit tacked on, like let's get a bit of action in there. It's sort of fun, but it doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the film and the intense feeling and the beautiful naturalistic kind of setting that he's set up. I think with the close-ups and the feeling and the passion, that comes out very clearly in Michael as well. I think there's a lot of that between the artist, the master, as he's called, and Michael, his
yeah.
Lover, I guess. It's
protégé.
Protégé. It's never made clear, yeah, but it's very strong.
All but explicit. Yeah. Mm. I think Michael's quite a difficult film in some ways. I mean, I like it, but it's hard to identify with any of the characters there, and we talk mm-hmm. about it as one of the earliest gay mm-hmm. films, but the most explicit gay line, I think, is when the artist says, you know, I'm already lonely and you can't mm-hmm. make me any lonelier. You don't have the right to make me any lonelier. Mm-hmm. It's quite a depressing view of, you know. But it's, again, it's beautiful. And again, mm-hmm. it's all about the eyes with the portrait. And
the interesting thing about the themes is that, well, it's got that epigraph that I finally know what love is. It links into his later works, like Gertrud, for example, with its similar epigraph. I think it's very interesting in many ways, but it's not, you know, fun.
No, it's not fun. And what is fun is Master of the House. I think that's great fun. I think it's fun for two reasons. One, because it's comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And two, because it's a kick-ass feminist film, wouldn't you say, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I love his female characters. I think they're very strong. The Parson's Widow
absolutely,
has
yeah.
that strong, well, the
both
widow,
the wife,
the title.
Both the widow and the betrothed, yeah, mm-hmm. Have that, yes. Do you think it was a successful season?
I mean, I think it's really hard to tell. I mean, I think the Audet theatrical release that mm-hmm. went alongside it, that got a bit of attention. it would have been really exciting if they could have shown The Passion of Joan of Arc with some of the more exciting soundtracks that have been written for it recently. Mm. Or, indeed, as an experiment, show it as he wanted it to be shown.
Completely silent. Talking of soundtracks.
Georges Méliès's La Voyage dans la Lune, which was justly celebrated in Martin Scorsese's Oscar-winning film Hugo, was gloriously reborn last year. A beautiful hand-coloured print of the movie was restored to its full beauty and premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. It really does look magnificent on the big screen, with the vivid colours of the new print both bringing an unexpected naturalism to the actors and exaggerating the film's magical vision of a lunar landscape. But not everyone was so pleased with the final restoration. French electronic duo Air had been commissioned to provide a score for the film, and let's say it wasn't to everyone's taste. Now, they have since expanded their score for the 14-minute movie into a full-length album, and we're going to play a track from the record called Parade to give you a flavour. London Film Festival, apparently someone screamed out, "Oh no," when they heard that music and they saw who had written it. What do you guys think?
I like it. It's that Dylan's gone electric moment. I think there's a place for all of this kind of stuff, and I particularly like working to silent film scores if I can find them online. The Pet Shop Boys Battleship Potemkin score, which you can listen to on Spotify, which I really like. Not sure how well it goes with the film, but it's really good fun to watch. I mean, I did see it when they performed at Trafalgar Square, which is great, one of my favourite silent film memories. But stuff like that I think is really good. And also, I think it's a great challenge. It's one of the things that really makes silent films live, is when people are making these scores for them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's great to hear things that aren't just the traditional way of doing scores, which is wonderful to hear when you go to a live performance. But, you know, it's nice to hear someone doing something different for the films.
Okay, that's great. I mean, I think later we're going to be talking about a film that had a very avant-garde score, but added to it recently. But moving onwards, outside of London, it's a very exciting time to be a British silent movie fan right now. We've got a summer full of silent Hitchcock to look forward to, and as we speak, the British Silent Film Festival is just a few days away. It takes place from the 19th to the 22nd of April this year, and is in a new venue too. At the precocious age of 15, the British Silent Film Festival has passed the entrance exam, gathered up its A-levels, and landed a place at Cambridge. So we've taken a look at the lineup and picked our highlights. Who wants to go first?
It's one of the. We were saying earlier when we were talking about the festival that it's great to see so many films that you don't see, and it's not just a this is an introduction to silent film thing, which I think is great. I think it used to be that way because that's what was available, and now it can't do that. I mean, for me, Saturday 9 a.m. Livingston is a really interesting piece. Written, directed, starring M.A. Weatherall, who I know nothing about. But Livingston was the patron saint of the British Empire, and at this point in time, his fame couldn't be more higher. I mean, every kid would have talked about it. So it's an obvious person to do a biopic of, and much of the write-up of the biopic does suggest that it may look to modernise a little dated and a little bit even racist. So, but I think those things are fascinating. I mean, I think those kind of lines between biography and ethnography and so on to modernise, you know, you've got to take them for what they were. But also, I think anything that's quite clearly a very personal project, but also it's like doing a biopic of Jesus at the time in some ways. It's sort of, you've got a guaranteed audience as long as you don't muck it up too much. I get a feeling he may have mucked it up a bit, so I'm quite interested to see it, if I can make it up for 9 a.m. on the Saturday morning.
Okay, well, you'll be on the coach.
I found it very interesting, just taking up what Pete was saying, that I don't actually know very many of these films or the filmmakers, so it's great to see that they're really finding some interesting stuff here. Not that British silent film is what I've...
How is it compared to New Zealand silent cinema?
There is barely any New Zealand silent cinema, I will say that much. and that's where I grew up. but I'm very interested in this one on the Friday, sorry. That sounds very interesting. Fascinating Gothic Curio, The Man Without Desire. I find anything that has the word curio in the title to be... in the write-up to be something that would... intrigue me, because it just sounds like it could be really odd and unusual. But
it's Ivan Novello, who's a great of British silent cinema, despite being known as a musician. Have you seen any of his other British films?
No, I don't think so. He was in quite a few Hitchcocks.
He was in the Rat films, which are Graham Cutts films, and he was in The Lodger. He was amazing in The Lodger, and he was also in Downhill.
Yes.
Downhill,
yes,
indeed. So that's an Adrian Brunel film. I mean, it's interesting, you know, there isn't perhaps a huge awareness of British silent cinema beyond Britain, and perhaps in Britain, but we have got some big names here for British silent cinema. Adrian Brunel, but we've also got a heck of a lot of Cecil Hepworth. So we've got even got some Tilly films, I think. A lot of Alma Taylor wandering around landscapes, which is always good. One thing that excited me, that I was interested in, was The Blackguard, which is a Cutts film. So that's Graham Cutts. And Hitchcock was working as an art director on this film, just like he was in The White Shadow, which was recently discovered in New Zealand.
To link up, because
everything comes back to New Zealand and its archives. And that's one I haven't seen, but there's a few here that I can heartily recommend.
Okay.
There's a whole strand of the festival that's about P.G. Wodehouse, who obviously we think of now, you know, Jeeves and Wooster. But, you know, he wrote some stories for films, and he had some stories that were adapted. And The Golden Butterfly is a great, please let me get on the stage and dance film. Mm-hmm. And it's set in both London and Cambridge, so that's a great one to see. Also, we've got The Firstborn. Now, I think, have you both seen The Firstborn
in
London?
Yeah, I saw it recently, the recent performance of BFI. It's terrific, and it's a terrific score as well.
Yeah.
But again, talking about autodidacts or whatever, we've got yet another writer, star, performer job in what seems to be some kind of fictionalised version of his own life, almost.
Well, Miles Mander, we can't say that he was actually a philanderer.
You can't libel the dead, though. Or slander the dead, sorry, radio.
I think it's interesting with The Firstborn, because it's really hard to tell people exactly how great it is. It's sex and lies and adultery, but it's named after a baby.
Yeah.
And it's by someone who we don't think of as a great British filmmaker, but it is a pretty strange
it's a
and nasty
pretty good film. Pretty good film. And there is obviously the Hitchcock connection, or at least Hitchcock's wife.
Yes, Alma Revel was working on that film. And also, anyone who's seen the 39 Steps will know that Madeleine Carroll is a wonderful actress, and she's really, really good in The Firstborn.
More grist to the suggestion that Alma was the real successful Hitchcock in that family. But we'll see later.
It's all about Patricia.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to as well on after Livingston hanging around to see the silent film fun of Animal Stars on the silent screen, because I love animal films, but also mainly because there's a Charlie Chase short in there where he's washing a Great Dane, and I'm a big fan of Charlie Chase.
Wow.
And I think seeing any film where just the idea of Charlie Chase washing a Great Dane, it's like a Marmaduke comic coming to life, but funny.
Mm.
Well, that's going to be good. I mean, I don't know whether you're a little bit too old for it. It's the family matinee.
So?
One thing I will say, this has actually provided me with quite a neat segue for once. So when I spoke to people on Twitter and Facebook that I was going to be doing this Silent London podcast, I asked people what they wanted me to talk about. And I had a couple of requests from Canada. And they wanted to know how to watch silent films, British silent films, outside Britain, because I think they're relying on quite expensive imported DVDs from the BFI and so forth. Well, all I can say is they're not widely available, but if there is one place you could look, you can go to the BFI YouTube channel, which it's the BFI Films YouTube channel, and you can see quite a lot of silent film in there. There's some snippets of Hitchcock, of Piccadilly, there's a vast array of Mitchell and Kenyon actualities, but also you've got a few Cecil Hepworths, including a film that I think may feature in your silent film fun with animals, which is The Dog Outwits the Kidnapper.
Ah, yes, yeah. That is, which is an absolute British classic.
Yeah, and Tilly the Tomboy film is there, and also the Alice in Wonderland clip that went viral a few years ago. Yeah.
Some good stuff.
So that would be my tip. And for everyone else, buy a ticket to Cambridge. So that's enough from us for a moment. We do welcome other voices onto this podcast. And a few days ago, I spoke to the film writer Mark Sinker, and I asked him to talk to me about his favourite silent film.
I'm Mark Sinker. I write about stuff, music and films and crisps and stuff. My favourite silent film is definitely Nosferatu. The first time I remember having an argument with someone about it was at school. My school friend came in and said that he'd seen this silly film on television, which was a silent horror film, and it was very ridiculous because it was silent and it wasn't scary at all. I didn't really have a good comeback at the time, but what I was feeling very strongly and articulately inside myself was I was really, really scared when I watched this film that you're saying is silly, and I think you're saying it's silly because you were scared too. It was Nosferatu, and the bit that I remember being really, really unsettled by is when they're on the boat. That is because there's nowhere to run away to. You're on a boat, and the people who are being threatened on the boat, they're not mimsy, screamy girls, and they're not the chiseled hero, and they're kind of people who don't really reappear. They're robust, muscly sailors who all die horribly and don't really even have names. One, they're the captain and the mate and some other people. And what was scary about it, first of all, it's on a boat, so you can't get away. And so there was something very claustrophobic in quite an unusual way about it. And the thing that I didn't really identify this for quite a long time afterwards, but there's actually something really well and scarily framed about the vampire, which is that every time he arrives on screen, you don't know what part of the screen he's going to emerge from. And this is actually, it's quite unusual anyway that people come on screen, you know, they come through the door, they come from the side or whatever. But there's something about the framing of this where it seems to me it's really carefully thought about, that when he arrives, he always arrives from a slightly unexpected quarter of the screen. And so you know he's coming, you know, because he's the monster and he's going to arrive, but you never quite know which bit of the screen he's going to emerge from. So sometimes he emerges from the darkness at the back and his face is never in the bit you think it's going to be, or his head comes from the bottom of the screen, or he comes from the side of the screen. It's never where you think it's going to be. And I think that was part of why I found it unsettling, was that on one hand, you know he's there, but you can't prepare for it or predict it, and they'd fashioned that very well. There's a kind of stickiness to the relationship between light and darkness, which is really quite unlike films that I've seen since or that I knew about in silent films at the time. I probably hadn't seen very many when I was a school child, and I've seen more now. But even so, it's not just the fact that it's technically part of the expressionist movement in film, and so it's about using very striking light and dark and shadow and distorted shapes and things like that, but there's a strange kind of clotted thickness to the light and dark and the colour and absence of colour and so on in the film, which I think is very particular to Nosferatu. And I don't know even what that's about, but that it is something that I'm always aware of when I'm watching it. And the things that my friend found kind of funny and silly, one of the things I remember him talking very particularly about is the way when he's on the boat and he's in the coffin, when he rises to his feet, he goes like all in a lump. He lifts himself up from his ankles. It's ridiculous. That's not something that people can do, and it's not something that it's like a trick rather than a thing. But actually, when you're actually watching it, it's not funny. It's kind of horrible. This is why I think when he said it's a silly film, what he meant is I was even more scared than I can possibly talk about. And the only way I can publicly discuss this is pretending it was nothing when it was really something.
Well, thank you, Mark Sinker. I have to apologise. It's purely on me. That was not recorded in a very silent part of London. That's coming at you from the streets of E10, which is warning to anyone I will nobble you to ask you about your favourite silent film at any point, so watch out. The thing that struck me listening to that really was that they showed Nosferatu on television.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a long time since that would happen.
It was actually on Film 4 last year.
And I missed that.
I think they might have done it as a double with Shadow of the Vampire.
That is possible.
And that's how it usually turns up now. You won't really understand this film unless you've seen this film. But,
right. Now, I cloistered myself in my university's AV suite and watched all the Murnaus in a row and all the Sternbergs and all these films and just, you know, take them all in. I was bored.
Well, thanks very much for providing us with a link, Ewan, because what I was going to talk about next was talking about silent films that are available on DVD and Blu-ray, and you both picked some favourite recent releases, and you wanted to talk about a Criterion box set.
Yes, they put out a set of three of Joseph von Sternberg's films last year, I think it was. Wonderful edition, Criterion, as always, beautiful packaging. Underworld, The Last Command, and Docks of New York. And I got that as, I think, a birthday present. And
happy birthday.
Indeed, it was. Well, that was last year, but...
I'm a bit late.
You've got around to seeing them now.
Yeah, no, I finally caught up with them. I'd seen them before, as I said, in the AV suite, but that was years ago. It was beautiful to see pristine, kind of, or as pristine as you can get of such old films. But, yeah, I mean, Joseph von Sternberg, von being
von
an addition.
Added afterwards, yes.
Like Lars von Trier.
He
is not aristocratic. Joe Sternberg. He was also starting about the same time as Dreyer, but obviously in the Hollywood. And this, I think Underworld was his second film, I think. I just think it's wonderful. There's all the same kind of... he uses a lot of close-ups, like Dreyer, with the action happening in the faces and the eyes rather than in the dialogue. It has silly conceits, like an underworld party. I mean, this was the first generic kind of gangster film.
It looks like a 30s gangster film. I mean, it's so like what we thought was invented a few years ago.
Well, it was written by Ben Hecht, who did Scarface later on. And in fact, he complained about Joseph von Sternberg's treatment of his original.
Everyone complained about Sternberg.
Everyone did literally complain about Sternberg. But so that's a wonderful film. And the other two are great too. Last Command is this one about Emil Jannings as this general who falls on hard times, eventually ends up in Hollywood and cast as an extra by a person that, you know, he served with, and just a reversal of fortune kind of thing. And I think it's a fascinating film. I mean, and they're all good. And it's a beautiful set. So
I think The Last Command, I mean, it's a wonderful film. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because it's about Hollywood, and it's fascinating because it has a strange relationship to all those other great silent films we watch from Soviet Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we feel that we're looking at these revolutionary stories from a completely different angle.
Yeah.
It's got something very different to talk about, though. Beautiful film.
Yes. Oh, a very beautiful film. The Great White Silence, which the BFI put out last year after their... wonderful restoration for the London Film Festival 2 years ago. I'm obviously right now it's Scotty's everywhere because it's his 100-year anniversary of him
dying.
Yes, well,
horribly.
of him getting to the pole and then dying, which the film covers in quite some detail, or
very movingly,
in much as it can do. And I think first of all, I mean, Ponting's direction and so on is wonderful, and he's he lived this stuff for about 20 years. He kept on recutting it. He kept on redoing it. Because, much again, like talking about Livingstone earlier, Scott again was another, you know, banner man of the Empire. But I think what's great about the this re-release, not only does it look fantastic and the tints are amazing on it and so on, but the score they commissioned, I think the BFI were very bold to go with a modern score. It's Simon Fisher-Turner's score, which I think is just remarkably atmospheric. It really it sums up a sense of desolation. It's innovative. It's clever. The highlight for me is what could have been the biggest mistake or the gimmickiest part of it is the bit where they take this recording of the sound of the inside of the hut.
It's because they actually say the soundtrack says this is a recording from,
and it actually says it, and you think all of a sudden you're kind of taken out of the film because there is sound and there is a voice, but when you realise what it is, even though there is nothing special about the air, there is nothing special about that, it just brings that sense of place that the visuals. Silent films can be distancing. Silent documentaries can be very distancing because of the time involved. But I think that just brings it bang up to date. And it's a fantastically moving film. It's got some very interesting animation in it. It's got too many penguins, perhaps.
Sacrilege. Have you seen South?
I have seen South, and that's got even more penguins. But yes, and actually, bearing in mind how the story of Scott and Amundsen was taught to schoolboys, it's relatively even-handed towards Amundsen. It doesn't vilify him as some kind of dog-eating savage.
Successful dog-eating savage.
So, yes, indeed. Well, if you're going to get to the South Pole, eat your dogs. Or at least make your sleds out of candy cane. You can eat that. But I think it's fantastic. I recommend it to anyone. It's not too long. It's fantastically moving, but it's also fantastically funny in places. And as I say, if you want to see penguins, it's not just, you know, all the other penguin, March of the Penguin films. There's a good proto-penguin action.
It's not Happy Feet 2.
Yeah.
But it's, it's very moving at the end. I mean, you know, the cinema I was in, I'm sure there were quite a few stifled tears when they're playing Abide With Me, I think.
Yeah.
Beautiful voice singing Abide With Me as we get into the very end section of the film. We all know what happens there. There's a bit of silence, and this one isn't... this one isn't labelled in the same way as other bits of silence. When we see a photograph of Scott and his team at the pole, dead silence on the soundtrack, and what silence that actually is, apparently, is Simon Fisher-Turner and his colleagues in the studio observing the minute silence on Remembrance Sunday. Mm. And just it's quite interesting to know that there's... You can hear a lot of the authenticity, and some of it you can just feel.
Well, I think that's interesting, going back to what you were saying about Passion of Joan of Arc, because I do think... I've seen a couple of silent films silently, and it does make a big difference sometimes. It can be very moving, and so I think that, and that's an example that really works.
Well, thanks very much. So The Great White Silence is available on dual format DVD and Blu-ray. It's a BFI release, and the Sternberg box set is a Criterion release, so it's region one, I think. But it's so, as many of you may know, Silent London, that's silentlondon.co.uk, by the way, publishes full listings for silent film screenings in London. Now, I've taken a quick look at the calendar of upcoming events, and I've got some picks for you that we haven't had a chance to talk about elsewhere today. So the first thing I want to bring to your attention is later in April. It's on the 29th of April. It's at the Barbican, and it's a film called Beggars of Life. Mm. I think we've all seen this.
Oh, yeah.
We all saw this last year at the festival. It's... Louise Brooks film. It's a Louise Brooks cross-dressing...
Wallace Beery film as well. Wallace Beery.
Wallace Beery doesn't cross-dress. Well, okay, not so much as Louise Brooks. Rail-riding hobos. It's a little bit like Sullivan the Travels, but with more fun. And it's a strange film. And the sort of the big attraction when you see it at the Barbican at the end of this month is the Dodge Brothers. Yeah, so it's got a skiffle, rockabilly soundtrack, and it works really well. I mean, the other thing to say is also that Dodge Brothers are turning up at the British Silent Film Festival.
The Ghost That Never Returns. That sounds fascinating.
More trains involved as well. It seems that they like to do a train film, Dodge Brothers.
Yeah, so if you like trains, and I really like trains, you want to check out some of the Dodge Brothers screenings. I think it's turning up at Bradford as well. The next thing I want to talk about is just because it's a new venue, so this is all very exciting. We all know about screenings at the Barbican and the BFI.
But, They're passé.
They're so passé. Yeah. There's a new cinema in London called the Hackney Picture House on Mayor Street, and it's got a little small room at the top called the Hackney Attic, and they're going to show quite a few film and live music events.
All right.
They are kicking off a monthly series of screenings with The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is a great expressionist, nightmarish horror film, and it's going to be accompanied by Minima, who I think we have all seen. Also, yes. It's a rock band with a cello, and they do very moody soundscapes.
Mm. They do like atmospheric scores, don't they?
Very atmospheric. You know, it works really well. I think it's going to work great in a small venue like that, particularly. And apparently the tickets, you can stay there for dinner as well.
Oh, wow.
So I saw the Mary Pickford film Sparrows, my London accent.
Sparrows. Silent London.
At the Hackney Picture House, and it was really well presented, and it does seem to be something, and it was very, very successful as well, so I think hopefully Hackney is going to keep going.
Silent Hackney.
I really hope so. I really love that venue that they have there. So.
Yeah, no, it is nice, and I think it's good that they've opened with a strong commitment to silent film.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. There's a cinema elsewhere in London that's already quite established itself as a venue for some alternative films, and that's the Ritzy in Brixton.
Mm-hmm.
They are showing, and what can I say? They're showing a programme of Argentine silent films on the same day, also on the 22nd of April. I've written a bit about this on the blog. I don't know a lot about Argentine silent cinema.
Well, you should go and find out then.
I found out a little. I found out that there wasn't much money in Argentine silent cinema. And we've got some films that are based on tangos. Mm-hmm. We've got some films that aren't based on tangos.
Right, okay.
Definitely worth going along. I think it's great when these national film festivals come into London and we get to see something a little bit different. So if you like tango music, get to the Ritzy. I've got one more.
Yep.
Which I think is sold out. But if there are any more tickets, Intolerance at the BFI South Bank, Monday, 23rd of April. Kevin Brown is introducing it. And you've got the recorded Carl Davis score. Speaks for itself.
Nice.
It's time for us to live up to our name and depart the airwaves. So do join us again for our next Silent London podcast, when we expect to bring you more chat, a full debrief from the British Silent Film Festival, and some happy hubbub about Hitchcock. So thank you to SOAS for welcoming us into your studio. Thanks to Pete. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Thanks to Ewan.
Thank you.
To Neil Brand, and thanks to you for listening. If you want to respond to anything we've been talking about today, you'll find all the details on the website at silentlondon.co.uk, together with all those silent film listings. Goodbye, and enjoy the silence.